Seized with an idea, I scrolled back past the video to see if I had taken any pictures at the resort. But I hadn't. The last photo on my camera roll was an image of an antique cymbal-playing monkey toy. A customer had brought it into the store where I work in hopes of making a trade. The monkey was old and well-loved, some of its fur rubbed off, the little battery compartment on its butt rusty and corroded. I stare into the middle distance, prickles dancing up my spine. When I purchased my phone, the setup prompts urged me to assign a security passcode, but I declined. I had a knack for forgetting numbers, and it seemed inevitable that I'd lock myself out again and again. I tried to set up fingerprint recognition, but the technology couldn't read my print right away, so I gave up. In other words, anyone could have accessed my phone without any trouble at all. Someone easily could have recorded the video. But who? I click the details button, but all it says is that the video was taken at the hospital. I stare at the little map of Palm Springs on the screen. I'd never realized the town was such a grid. My throat is dry. My head is throbbing. But all of a sudden, it seems foolish to me to be just lying here, inactive. I have proof now. Someone was running away. Someone followed me to that pool. Someone could still be following me now. I push off my covers and head down the stairs. I'm still in the acid-wash jeans from the hospital, but there's no time to change. I find my house keys at the bottom of my purse and ready them at the door. My car isn't here, so I'll have to take an Uber, but that won't be a problem. Where I'm going, I'm not sure. I just have to go somewhere. I have to figure this out. Then a hand clamps on my shoulder. I squeal and jump back. "You're not going anywhere." I turn around. It's my roommate, Kiki Ross. She slides around me, grabs my keys from my hands, and blocks the door. Her eyes are wide. Her mouth turns down with fear and possibly anger. "Come here, Eliza," she says in a low voice. "We need to talk." From the Dots. A few months later, Dot was in the hospital again. The doctors at the new hospital thought they'd fixed her with a new mixture of medications, but her seizures returned one spring day at home, shortly after lunch. The first one came on strong, with bright lights kaleidoscoping in her eyes. Her mind peeled away from her body and lay in flakes on the floor. Dorothy hurried her back to the hospital. Back to Dr. Osuri and the children's ward with the cheerful yellow walls and hot air balloon mural. Back to the same room with the television remote that only worked sporadically. Dot waited for her mother to show up. Hours passed. Finally, she rushed in, still in scrubs.
"I'm sorry,"
Dot's mother said in a begging tone.
"I came as soon as I could. There was an emergency patient. I didn't have my phone, and no one told me."
She bit her lip.
"Your aunt should have called the front office like I always tell her to."
"It's fine,"
Dot said, calmly, distantly. Dorothy was here, after all. She was off buying magazines at the gift shop. More tests, a few days of feeling better, and then a relapse. Dot wondered what Stella, the lookalike from St. Mother Maria's, was up to. Now, a sad-eyed woman in a brown headscarf took her blood pressure most days. She had very cold hands and made a funny sniffing sound as she checked the gauge. All the nurses were distant this visit, unsmiling and serious, as if they were keeping a grave secret from Dot. Dot asked Dorothy what was going on. Dorothy sniffed.
"They're just snotty, jealous bitches. They can't stand that we're so pretty."
"But they're nice to the other kids. That one girl down the hall, Sarah, they give her lollipops, like, all the time."
"Yes, but that's because Sarah has a wealthy father. There's always an angle, Dot."
Dorothy waved her finger.
"Always an angle."
And then, a goodish day. Dot could see straight. She could eat. At lunch, an aide wheeled in a cart from the children's lending library across the street. She must have been going to an adult ward next because Dot noticed a Los Angeles magazine on the top of a stack on a lower shelf. When Dot saw her own face on the cover, she drew in a sharp breath. She looked shorn and dopey, her arms the circumference of pencils, her veins visible through translucent skin. Next to her was her aunt, her black hair sleek and straight, her skin flawless and her violet eyes wide. "Fighters," read the big yellow caption, and then Dorothy Banks, Magnolia Hotel resident, puts her hopes and dreams on hold to save her dying niece's life. Dying. The words sliced through Dot's veins, hot as coffee. She'd certainly thought enough about death, even her own death, but she hadn't realized she was actually, literally dying. It seemed impossible. She thumbed through the pages. The story was embedded among slick pieces about Beverly Hills home renovations and ads for plastic surgeons. Dot read every word of the piece, focusing on words like cancerous and inoperable and terminal. She'd never heard the doctors describe her illness in those terms before. She ran to the bathroom and threw up pinkish gummy chunks in the sink. When she returned to her room, Dorothy had reappeared. She was fluffing up the pillows and humming. A nurse named Lisa stood in the corner, pretending to busy herself with Dot's medications. Then Dorothy noticed the magazine on the bed. "Ah," she said to Dot, "so you've seen it." "When was this picture taken?" Dot demanded, so angry her teeth were chattering. Dorothy lowered her eyes. "A few months ago, dear, when you were at the other hospital. Don't you remember?"
"No."
Dot tore through her memories. She tossed useless visions aside like limp t-shirts she had no interest in wearing. There was nothing in her brain about a photo shoot. She would have never allowed a photographer to take a picture of her when she looked so grotesque. But that was the trouble with her brain. Sometimes memories dropped out of her entirely, like water through a sieve. She grabbed the magazine and stuffed it into the trash can, though not before checking out her picture one last time.
"I look awful."
"Oh, darling, the article brings awareness to your case. Everyone will see now how sick you are. I'm thinking of starting a foundation for donations. That article is all about you."
Lisa cleared her throat. Dorothy glanced at her and set her mouth in a line. "The article hardly mentioned me except to say I was dying," Dot said. It was difficult to even say the word out loud. "It said my tumor was cancerous and inoperable. I thought my tumor was gone. And no one told me I have cancer."
"You don't," Lisa answered loudly. "It says that?"
Dorothy glanced at the trash can. Dot was afraid she was going to fish the magazine out, but instead she folded her hands in her lap and remained seated.
"Honestly, darling, sometimes reporters, well, they exaggerate things. Look, it doesn't matter. People probably won't read the article. They'll just look at the picture and the headline. That's what's important."
"They'll still see the picture of me then."
"You don't look so bad."
Dot wasn't in the mood for lies.
"Has Mom seen this?"
Her aunt's head shot up. Her skin seemed to visibly gray.
"You know, I was doing this as a favor to you. I was just trying to make sure you didn't end up like Thomas. I'm certain there was something wrong with his brain, but no doctor would listen. It's articles like this that get doctors to sit up and notice. But I'll leave you alone, since that's what you crave."
She walked out and shut the door, hard. Dot stared at the door, shocked. Across the room, Lisa sighed. Dot's gaze fell numbly to the tiles on the floor. They were a faded avocado green color and covered in scuff marks. She pushed the beaded bracelet Dorothy had given her when she first got sick around her wrist. It had a bunch of skeleton charms on it. Charm bracelets were out of favor this year at her school, but she didn't want to take it off.
that would hurt her aunt's feelings. Lisa glided over and touched her shoulder.
Hey there, hon. Want me to stay for a little bit?
We could play Uno.
Dot shook her head yes, then felt the ever-present tug.
Maybe bring my aunt back in, if she's still here?
Lisa's face fell.
Are you sure?
See if she's out there, please?
It took two more pleases, but Lisa did as Dot asked. Dorothy walked in with a sour look on her face.
You must hate me,
Dot blurted.
You're lucky the elevator was taking a long time, Dorothy said at the same time.
They looked up at each other. Dorothy bent down and pressed her chest to Dot's.
Why, I could never hate you, darling, she said, looking into Dot's eyes, as honest as she'd ever been. I'm your biggest fan.
A few days after the Los Angeles incident, Dorothy came into Dot's room excitedly. Dot looked at her through a curtain of exhaustion. She'd been having so many seizures lately. They pounded her hard, huge waves rolling onto a rocky shore. Her brain actually felt tired from so much quaking. Sometimes, in quiet moments, she thought death might be kind of nice. Not nearly as chaotic, anyway.
The doctors are having a meeting about your condition, Dorothy crowed. Apparently, you're a bit of a medical mystery. And guess what? They're letting me sit in on it. Isn't that wonderful?
Dot blinked at her. She lingered on the medical mystery part. Dorothy preened about the room.
Thank God they finally respect me. Now we'll be sure they aren't lying to us. I'll get the real dirt.
You think the doctors are lying? Dot asked. Dorothy didn't answer. Dorothy wore a silk caftan and Chanel pumps for the meeting. She hired a makeup artist to do her face.
Wish me luck, she said before she went into the conference room.
The meeting was at 10 a.m. The clock crawled to 11, and then 12, and still no Dorothy. At 12:30, Dorothy finally returned. She'd eaten off all her lipstick, and she was muttering.
What happened? Dot asked, turning off Days of Our Lives.
The doctors are wrong, Dorothy said. It's asinine. Irresponsible.
Dot felt a pull in her chest. What did they say? Had the tumor returned? Would she have to endure radiation again? That hot line turning her insides to liquid, reducing her to molten piles of stones. It was bizarre. Despite all the seizures, her MRIs kept coming back clean. But maybe the scans weren't catching everything.
They're going to transfer you. They want you in the ICU without visitors. They're saying it's so they can rule out anything environmental that might be causing your seizures. But I think that's bullshit. I think it's a conspiracy.
They're putting me in a room without visitors?
I'm filing a complaint, don't you worry. But I'm not sure it's up to me anymore.
Dorothy's gaze shot to Dot. Her pupils were hard black pins.
What have you been saying about me?
Dot grabbed a handful of sheets.
Nothing.
They trick you. They pretend they're your friends. They get all buddy-buddy. Darling, you had to have said something. I believe they're putting you, us, in the ICU as punishment.
Punishment? For what? Had Dot somehow slipped to them that she'd had a sip of Dorothy's wine a few days before when Dorothy had turned her back? Or did she tell them she'd stolen the M&M's packet off the desk at the nurse's station? Dot had moved during a recent MRI, too. The tech hadn't commented, but he also hadn't said they needed to repeat the procedure. She'd just been so itchy.
I'm sorry,
Dot whispered, her bottom lip wobbling.
I don't know why they do this.
Dorothy took off her left shoe, rubbed her ankle, then put it on again.
Just know you can't trust them. Ever.
Can't we just move to another hospital?
It's not so easy, honey. Not anymore. They called your mother.
Surely she doesn't want me in there all alone.
Her aunt made a strange coughing sound.
Look, I'm not trying to make her out as the bad guy, but I think she was in on this decision too.
She set her jaw.
Anyway, I have to go.
What?
Dot sat up straight.
You can't leave.
I have an appointment.
She stroked Dot's arm.
I'll be back. Don't worry. Just be good, okay? As long as you're good, it will all work out fine.
She sauntered out of the room in a heady scent of orange blossoms. Dot couldn't control her tears. She sobbed uncontrollably for at least 10 minutes. She was surprised the crying didn't propel her into a new seizure. She didn't know what to make of any of it. Had her mother been in on the decision? What if she'd proposed the idea? What if this was some way to get her away from Dorothy? She was jealous, maybe, because clearly Dorothy had taken her place. But why did Dorothy leave? Why wasn't she fighting this? She'd fought so hard for everything else. A few minutes later, Nurse Lisa swept in and pulled out Dot's IV tubes. Then she ordered her out of bed so she could strip her sheets. She dressed Dot in another gown and took her to X-ray and to draw blood.
But you already drew blood today,
Dot whined.
We just want to make some comparisons, Lisa said cheerfully.
Dot had yet another MRI and CAT scan that day, too. And after all that, with no explanation, they wheeled her into the ICU. It was deathly quiet in the ward. Dot's room was tiny and had a strange smell she didn't recognize. She was old enough to understand that all around her were other children who were very, very sick. Probably some of them would die soon. Feeble wails from babies woke her up in the night. Sounds of vomiting. A woman standing outside her door, crying uncontrollably. What on earth could Dot have done to land her in here? Had she done something disparaging in her sleep? Did the nurses know that she and Dorothy made fun of some of them when it wasn't their shifts? Maybe the rooms had little microphones hidden in them, like in the movies, and the nurses heard everything. If Dot just apologized, could she go back to the normal ward? Or was she really this sick? And then, in the morning, she heard Dr. Osuri's voice.
I said you couldn't be here. What part of that don't you understand?
Dot strained to hear whom the doctor was talking to. Had some madman broken into the ICU? She hallucinated axe wielders, orange storm clouds, pointy horned ibexes. The drugs she was taking to quell the seizures made her so drowsy, and she dropped back into sleep. Just before she slipped into unconsciousness, she saw her mother standing in the doorway, her arms crossed over her chest, a tight, worried look on her face. Dot probably could have struggled to stay awake to say hello to her, but she didn't want to. A few hours later, Dr. Osuri came in to check on her, praising her for having no new seizures in the night.
See, I'm better, Dot crowed, so get me out of here.
Dr. Osuri chuckled.
Soon, I promise.
There was a sad, kind look on his face. Dot was sure this hadn't been the same doctor who'd been yelling at someone earlier in the day. 3 days in the ICU, no new seizures. Dot played solitaire on an iPad. A nurse gave her the wireless password and she watched toy reviews on YouTube. Her mother appeared in the doorway, but every time, Dot pretended to be sleeping. Patients around her moaned. An alarm went off in the middle of the night. Nurses and doctors hurried into an adjoining room, and there was a flurry of tense instructions and bleeps of machinery. Dot was astonished to fall asleep amid the cacophony. In the morning, when she woke up, she had no idea if the person who had the episode so late at night had lived or died. Her brand new cell phone, which Dorothy had bought for her but which Dot didn't quite know how to work yet, received text messages. a very new thing.
Are you being good?
Dorothy had texted her. Dot answered yes.
Not talking to anyone?
Dot answered no.
Good. And don't think anything either, she said. Because they can read your thoughts.
Who? Dot always asked. Dorothy never answered. Eliza. Kiki leads me into the kitchen. I am silent. My heart is banging. Her brother Sedman, who's my other roommate, stands at the island, hip thrust out, an I Heart Zombies coffee cup in hand. He's glaring at me. Hi? I say uncertainly. What's going on? Sedman snorts, the very action making his blonde, feathery bangs lift from his forehead. His eyes are dark-rimmed, as if he has applied eyeliner. He's pear-shaped, with a big ass. A lot to grab onto. Today he's got on a gray sweatshirt that's too tight, as well as fitted black jeans and shiny high-top leather sneakers. By the smell of it, there's bone broth in that mug. I have some in the house, as it's supposed to annihilate all bad cells in the body, and though I can't take the flavor, he finds it delicious. Kiki stands at the island with a meek look on her face. The only similarity between her and Stedman are their striking ice blue eyes. I met Kiki at the writing group I joined earlier this year. I'd been working on the dots, and I needed someone to read a draft, but I didn't want that someone to be anyone I knew. I couldn't imagine letting my mother look at it, and all of my college friends were majoring in business or some sort of useless science-like mumbo-jumbo having to do with quarks. I doubted they'd be useful in offering critique. When I saw the poster for a writer's group advertised on a bulletin board at Trader Joe's, I thought, why not? The woman who started the group, Sasha, held the meeting in her apartment, which overlooked the very Trader Joe's parking lot where I found the ad. The apartment was filled with a lot of Native American decor. Masks, beaded things, feathers, a wooden canoe mounted on the wall. And smelled like tobacco. Low, atonal, rhythmic chants played over the stereo. There was a bowl filled with small, smooth stones on her coffee table. I worried them between my fingers, terrified to pull the 6 sets of 8 stapled pages I had made for the group out of my bag. It was the first 2 chapters of the dots. I was terrified for anyone to read it. Then, it would be real. Kiki sat next to me that first day. She had threads of gray through her hair and carried herself with the air of a much older, wiser woman, so I was surprised to find out later she was only 27. She wore a flowing skirt sewn together with rainbow-colored quilted strips, and she smelled like Strawberry Shortcake's little plastic head. When she noticed me, I must have been putting off a serious fear vibe, because she gave me a comforting pat on the hand. The others in the group sat on the wicker chairs and beanbags Sasha had piled together in the room. Sasha cleared her throat and looked at me. Eliza, ready to pass around? My fingers crimped around my pages. I wasn't sure I could let go of them. They were so unvarnished and inadequate. All at once, I desperately had to pee. That always happened when I got nervous. How about I go? Kiki piped up. I have some new poems. Sasha looked at her evenly. Someone near the door groaned. Kiki passed out her poems. Pages riffled. The room went silent. As I read, I began to relax. Her poems were about astrology and vaginas. They were written in iambic pentameter and couplets. She'd rhymed uterus and Oedipus. The critique began. As everyone tactfully pulled Kiki's pieces apart, she sat quietly on the couch, her posture perfect, her expression serene and pensive. By the end of the session, I finally felt ready to show my work, but Sasha deemed that the group was over for the night. Everyone stood to leave. Kiki turned to me and smiled. Well, I think I need a drink after that. I went out with her out of guilt. I'd sent her lousy writing to slaughter in place of mine. But Kiki didn't see it that way. I appreciate everyone's feedback, but I'm submitting those pieces to poetry just as they are, she announced, smoking a joint as she walked. At the bar, Kiki Germexed the tabletop while we waited for the bartender to get the drinks. Bar counters are worse than public bathrooms, she said in that same placid tone that never seemed to leave her voice. She told a long, convoluted story about various relationships and breakups with seamy-sounding men at least 30 years her senior. Her parents had owned a dandelion farm when she was young, and they made special tea that hippies bought through mail order. But now the dandelion industry has dried up, and they live in a subdivision near Pasadena, where Kiki lived as well. At one point, Kiki sipped her vodka, made a face, and plucked an extra lime out of the cubby behind the bar that contained maraschino cherries, olives, and cut-up fruit. I like how she looked right at the bartender when she did it, daring him to say something to her about presumptuousness and personal hygiene. A few months later, when my book sold and I collected some cash, I asked Kiki if she wanted to be my roommate. I didn't enjoy bumping around in the new, free-from-my-parents' house by myself. I kind of wished I were still in the dorm at UCLA. I liked the idea of having 55 sleeping co-eds just a knock away. Kiki was happy to leave her parents' dumpy tract home. Her deal, though, was that if she moved in, her brother Stedman, who was living at home, had to come too. Otherwise, he's never going to leave my parents' house, and they're so sick of him, she said. I knew the feeling. I asked what Stedman did, and Kiki said he managed a curiosity shop in Venice. Does he need extra employees? I asked immediately. I pulled 18-hour days working on my book, but once I'd finished, I needed something else to occupy my time. I was up to taking 4 baths a day. Many hours passed where all I did was thumb through a big Edward Gorey anthology. Now, I pad to the fridge, open it, and grab a bottle of water. The shelves are stuffed with Trader Joe's fare. Stedman's name is written on the soy milk and individual pots of Greek yogurt. He pens SR across the skin of each individual clementine in the bag. This is why I moved my vitamins upstairs. I don't want to have to put my name on them. I can feel Kiki and Stedman staring at me.
So, is it true?
Stedman asks. What's that? I ask after taking a long drink. The pool, Eliza. Kiki holds up her phone. Did you almost drown? I swallow hard. How do you know that? Could Desmond have told them on his way out? A website in Palm Springs wrote a piece about you. I just read it. I thought it was for your book, but it's about someone pulling you out of a swimming pool. So it is in the news. I snatch the phone from her. Woman rescued from near drowning, reads the headline on the screen. The story posted 20 minutes ago. My Google alert, which I'd set to ping whenever a mention of me popped up online, must have missed it. The article says a young woman, 23, fell in the pool and that police were called. They mention my name, but there's no picture of me. No mention of foul play either. I hand it back quickly, feeling queasy. This doesn't tell the whole story.
Okay, what's the whole story? What happened in Palm Springs is her business, Kiki.
Stedman interrupts. He looks at me.
But if you're going through something, maybe you should talk to us. I mean, I have a business to run. And when you show up on your off days acting erratic, the business loses money.
I squint. Huh?
What happened on Friday, Eliza? You showed up all, I don't know, weird.
He wiggles his arms and shoulders, octopus style, to demonstrate weird. I squint, trying to remember Friday. As far as I know, I hadn't left the house. My big excursion to Palm Springs had happened the following day. What are you talking about? I ask. Stedman sips from his mug and swallows noisily.
Herb said you came in all dazed, but when he tried to talk to you, you clammed up and left. You freaked him out, which says a lot, you know?
Herb was wrong. That wasn't me. He slaps his arms to his sides.
Eliza, come on. It was you. So what are we dealing with here? Drugs? Alcohol? Do you need to go to rehab?
Look, I'm fine. And if I did do that, I'm really sorry. I try adding a little laugh. How about we just forget this?
Kiki grips a Bakelite napkin ring in the shape of a tarantula. Over Stedman's head is a squirrel skeleton. The moment Stedman moved in, he brought tons of knickknacks from the curiosity shop with him. And though I don't mind most of it, the raccoon penis he fashioned into the centerpiece of a dreamcatcher that hangs over the sink doesn't exactly put me in the mood to do dishes.
This is all so worrying, Kiki says quietly. All your memory lapses, and now the drowning thing.
I didn't drown. I'm still here.
But you tried to drown, Kiki points out.
No, I didn't. I consider mentioning the murder angle, but this is definitely the wrong audience.
It was an accident.
Silence. Stedman taps his long nails against the mug. Kiki stares out the window and looks like she wants to cry. I've still got Maneater in my head. Oh, here she comes.
When you say all my memory lapses, I say, can you give me another example?
Well, there was that time 2 weeks ago when I saw you at yoga, Kiki says. You were leaving, I was coming. I waved, and I swear you saw me. But then I bring it up later, and you look through me like I'm nuts.
I try to laugh. I remember that. Or I remember you telling me you'd seen me at yoga. But I wasn't there. I haven't been to your studio in months.
I tried to like yoga. I really did. But I kept laughing through the instructor's chants. I kept rolling my eyes at the Sanskrit names for the poses.
But I saw you, Kiki asserts. You looked right at me.
My gaze shifts down. Could I have been there? Why don't I remember?
I think you were confused, I insist.
The siblings exchange another look. Stedman starts to pace.
It's other things, too. Not keeping up with the household responsibilities when you say you're going to, not cleaning like the schedule dictates.
I blink hard. Wait, that thing was real?
Stedman put up a chore schedule on a white marker board in the mudroom. I'd actually made fun of it to Kiki.
Maybe even in front of Stedman.
Plus, you sometimes eat our food, and you use the toilet paper you didn't buy. And you never paid cable last month, and we basically had to go without cable until the two of us coughed up some funds, Stedman adds. And you said you were going to get cable. You said you called the cable company.
It's my house, I exclaim. If I don't want to have cable, then we're not going to have cable.
But as soon as I see the rage in his expression, I realize my mistake. If Stedman leaves, Kiki might too. I mumble a half-hearted apology and head out the door. I don't slam it. That might qualify as erratic, unstable behavior. The kind of behavior defined by people who drink too much and don't own up to skipping yoga and who throw themselves into swimming pools. I walk the whole way to the edge of the property line before I turn around and give the house the finger. Chore charts? Cable? Really? It's mild outside, and the sun has sunk below the trees. I start to walk, hoping movement will settle me down. Halfway to Riverside Drive, I hear footsteps and turn around. It's Kiki. She's barefoot, and her eyes are red, and her golden hair is flying behind her like the tail of a kite.
Eliza, she calls.
I consider running, but she'd catch me by the end of the block, so I stop. My arms hang heavily at my sides.
I'm sorry.
She's breathing hard.
I didn't know my brother was going to say all those things.
You could have stood up for me.
Kiki twists her mouth.
I know. But Stedman, he... Well, whatever. She smiles sheepishly.
And it's kind of true, honey. Lately you've seemed barely aware of your life.
She puts her hand on my arm.
Are you sure there's nothing you want to talk about?
I stare down at Kiki's pale, freckled hand. She's got a thick plastic ring with a plastic roach trapped inside of it. She got it at Stedman's shop, but she doesn't work there. Part-time, she plays an Elsa from Frozen for birthday parties, company meetings, ribbon-cutting ceremonies, and for hungover fraternity brothers. It's weird who requests an Elsa. You never know. Anyway, she wears the ring while princessing it up, the bugs spun toward her palm. She says it gives her power. Everything I need to tell weighs on me with the dull, pressing force of a dentist's x-ray bib. Not just the drowning. Not just the person Desmond saw running away. But everything else, too. I never told Kiki about the suicide attempts. I never told her about my tumor. I don't want her looking at me differently. And I know she would. I don't want her pitying me. Though it seems like she is anyway. Maybe, though, it would be okay to have a friend to worry with. It's one thing for my family not to believe me about jumping into the pool. It's another for Kiki to say, unprompted, that I'm having memory problems. What if I am still sick? What if the tumor has come back? Some people are good at crossword puzzles or jujitsu. Maybe I'm good at making tumors nestle inside my skull. Only, what about that person running away? What is that, then? I can't tell Kiki. Just uttering those words, just giving my condition shape and air, means that this sudden and sharply defined worry might be truth. I'm fine, I say quietly. I'm just tired. Freaked out about the book, maybe. Afraid people aren't going to like it. Of course, Kiki says. It's got to be a lot of pressure. But you should be happy about it, Eliza. You're getting published in, what, a month? It's going to be amazing. She slaps the sides of her thighs. Want to get dinner somewhere? I'm up for anything. There's a lump in my throat. I just want to take a walk by myself. Of course, of course. She pulls me in one more time for a hug. She smells like weed, and her weight against mine makes my throat lump six sizes bigger. Get some baked Alaska at Bob's Big Boy, she murmurs in my ear, and a big glass of milk. I start walking. It's after 5, and Burbank is dead. The roads are wide and empty, perfect for drag races. A girl wipes off the tables of the greasy Mexican joint, and tinkling mariachi music escapes out of the speakers. A high-end Mercedes slips silently out of the gates of Warner at the end of the road, then makes a slithery turn onto Olive, escaping for the highway. Its stealthy, amphibious motion triggers memory upon memory of all the weird, unexplainable things I'd recently done. Like jumping the fence of a chain motel and plunging into the first body of water I could find, which happened to be a large outdoor hot tub. I forced my face into the hot water. Only when I couldn't breathe did I feel relief. It's going to end. I'll be free. Or the memory of riding a bike down the path that cuts through Santa Monica and Venice beaches, and suddenly, arrestingly, having a palpable fear that someone was chasing me. I turned around, and I did see someone. Maybe lots of someones. All with angry, vengeful eyes. The only way I could fathom getting away was plunging into the Pacific. So I'd made a madcap run across the sand. A wave had taken me down immediately. A father and son dragged me out after the breath had left my body. Why is she coughing? The little boy kept asking. Is she going to be okay? And the memory of 2 nights ago, when I'd crashed into the pool at the Tranquility. The cold water had been so shocking, but once again I'd felt safe. I flailed onto my back and for a moment opened my eyes. I stopped short just before the curb cut. There was someone on the pool deck, just like Desmond said. The glare from a spotlight blotted out any discernible features, but whoever it was stood above me, chest puffed triumphantly as I sank. I grab my phone and dial the police station again. The same receptionist picks up, and I can't remember Lance's last name again, and I can't bear to go through the spiel of the message one more time. I hang up, and demand my phone's automated assistant give me the number to the Tranquility. "Can I be connected to the Shipstead bar?" I ask after the front desk answers. There's a pause, and then someone else picks up.
"Shipstead."
It's a man with an Australian accent. Shipstead.
"G'day," I say.
Whenever I hear an accent, I have the urge to speak with one too.
I'm a private detective, and I'm checking in on my client's wife. She says she was at your bar a few nights back, and I want to see if she was there the whole time or if she left and went somewhere else.
Okay. He sounds circumspect.
Which day was this?
I tell him.
I wasn't here Saturday. That was Richie.
Is he working today?
Nope.
When will he next be in?
Tomorrow, I think. Or the next day.
I might be dead by then.
My accent is gone.
Can you give me his cell phone number?
The bartender bursts out laughing.
No.
And then he hangs up.
There's a blare of a horn, and I jump. I've wandered into the crosswalk. I scamper to the curb, my heart in my throat. The image I've just seen of someone standing above me as I sink into the pool in Palm Springs skulks around me like a sullen cat. There had definitely been a shadow standing motionless over me, making sure I was floundering to the bottom. On my phone, I Google Tranquility Resort pool accident. The article Kiki showed me is the only one listed. There were no reported accidents to the resort's pool besides mine. Then I Google Palm Springs stalkers. A 24-year-old girl was stalked by an ex-boyfriend. A 45-year-old nurse posted sexy pictures of herself in Palm Springs on Facebook, and some crackpot stalked her to the Elvis honeymoon hideaway. Neither situation has much in common with what happened to me. I Google Los Angeles stalkers, but that brings up too many hits to wade through. Next, I search, can the police lie to you? And police cover-ups. And finally, how to get a memory back from your brain. This leads me to an article about post-traumatic stress disorder, which tells me something I already know. Memories, especially powerful and emotional ones, are stored in the amygdala, where my tumor resided. These same memories are fragile and easily destroyed when they aren't given time and space to form. There's a whole biochemical and electrical process that fixes a memory in place. Also, just because you think you remember something happening doesn't mean it actually occurred the way you remember it. Brains have a tendency to rewrite memories based on what you'd like to remember, or what someone has told you to remember. Or your mind might conflate two memories into one, the synapses in the brain getting tangled and confused. Is that it? Am I confusing the pool incident with an earlier plunge? I want to think so, but no. That face standing over me is so crisp in my mind. I have to believe in it. Once I start doubting myself, the memory will slip away forever. I need to lie down somewhere. I gaze at the sidewalk, considering it. The street is clean enough to eat off. Then I spot an even more tempting option. A corner bar across from Warner's that used to be a whorehouse. There's a winking floozy painted onto the window, a neon wine bottle above the bar. I wonder if a certain someone is inside. My mouth starts to water. My body actually lunges toward the place like a plant leaning toward a ray of light. I push through the door and am greeted by twilight gloom. It's a bar with multiple personalities. The jukebox, bad lighting, and bathroom of questionable cleanliness suggest dive. But then there's this whole wine cellar corner thing going on. The menu features beef cheeks, and there's a PBS news broadcast on TV. I settle into a stool and gaze down the sparse line of patrons. Most of them, like everyone hanging out in Burbank at this time of day, are either studio people who don't want to be bothered, or screenplay hopefuls who are hoping to rub elbows with someone who will listen to their pitch. The bartender, Brian, tosses a coaster my way with a grumble. He's always muttering to some guy about what cunts women are, how they're liars, how they make no sense, how they're whorish and opportunistic, and way more superficial than men. I also can't stand his hipster beard. "Gin and tonic," I shout to him. He begrudgingly makes it, silently plops it in front of me, and sticks the paper bill in an empty glass. Then I feel a sort of magnetic pull, and I know the person I've come for is here before I actually see him. There he is. Denim jacket, stubble, floppy hair, square jaw. He's sitting at the other end of the bar, reading a magazine. As if suddenly aware of my presence, he looks up and stares at me, too. His lips twitch. He stands and walks over with a bear-like lope. I stretch off the stool and roll on the insteps of my feet, heart pounding, seething at the sight of him, but also relaxing, knowing exactly how this will play out.
"Liza," he says when he's close. "Long time no see."
I don't know if he gets my name wrong on purpose, or if he really doesn't know it. It's also possible I've given him this name instead of my real one. "I've been busy," I answer. He takes a long sip of his drink. It's something brownish with clinking ice cubes, and passes it to me. He knows I'm not picky. He knows I'll drink it, which I do. It's whiskey, the cheap kind. My throat feels gouged. He looks me up and down, his eyes twinkling.
"You busy now?"
I raise my eyebrows at him. "Not really." There may be a little more talk than this, maybe even a gin and tonic or two, probably more glares from Brian. But what matters is that after not very much time, Andrew grabs my hand with urgency, and there we are in that horrid bathroom with its crumbling grout and the shit-stained toilet and the foul-smelling urinal cake, my body pressed up against the wall, his fingers rushing to unzip, me feverishly pulling the grungy hospital t-shirt over my head. I shut my eyes and sink into this as best I can. There is acid in my throat. I may vomit soon. But for a few seconds, I can forget everything about who I am and be some girl I don't know, some waste, a putrid, repulsive Liza a man wants to ravage. That's all I am worth deep down. I don't know why this sort of depravity feels necessary, but it does. Maybe it's another trick of my amygdala. It's over fast. Andrew hands me a cigarette. He's always got a pack. He smokes one, too. We blow the smoke out the bathroom window into the alleyway. A limp hank of hair falls across Andrew's forehead. I tap his arm. "Is that a studio pass around your neck?" He flicks the ashes from his cigarette into the toilet. The water fizzles.
"Maybe."
"You working on a writing team?"
"Maybe."
When we first met, he admitted that he hoped to work on a TV drama, maybe a police procedural. This was when we'd had a normal, flirty bar conversation, before he understood I was easy and desperate and didn't need verbal foreplay to strip naked. But I didn't play the game entirely. I told him nothing about myself. But now, I kind of want to tell him something. I just don't know what. I think of it as he's zipping up. "I was almost killed 2 nights ago." He looks at me, really looks at me, and raises an eyebrow. Then he snorts and rolls his eyes.
"Yeah, right."
"It's true." An additional thought appears in my mind with astonishing force. "And I could kill you, too." I almost gasp out loud, shocked my mind coughed that up. He licks his finger and uses it to stub out the cigarette. It makes a dangerous sizzle, and he drops it in the toilet. Another sideways glance, and then he finally buttons his pants.
"We've all got our stories, Liza.
We've all got our stories." From the Dots. After Dot was banished to the ICU, Dorothy's schedule got very busy. She wrote Dot cards that the nurses passed through that explained she was in meetings. Maybe Riders of Caraway was finally getting published. Maybe she'd met a man, husband number 3. Dot had gotten over the Los Angeles magazine thing, mostly because it had had the reverse effect of what she'd feared. Recently, the doctors had decided to allow her 15 minutes of visiting time a day, and 7 kids from school had come to see her. They'd brought candy, DVDs, and paperback books she hadn't read yet. A pale girl named Matilda, who Dot had always admired, sat at the side of her bed and marveled at the needle marks on Dot's arms. 2 days later, another card from Dorothy came. She was going on a 3-month trip for research. Dot was horrified. She called Dorothy's cell phone.
"How can you leave me in here?"
Dot cried.
I know," Dorothy said. "But you're strong. You can handle this. And I've let work go for a very long time, dear. An agent is finally interested, and they've given me a deadline. I've got to get back to it."
"But I thought the book was done," Dot said.
"That's the thing," Dorothy said. "People aren't into barbarian novels right now. My agent wants me to restructure it and make it about the Holy Grail. So it's essential, you see, that I go to southern France. This new direction won't work unless I see the region firsthand."
Dot seemed to sense a distance in her, like her aunt was angry at something Dot had done. Did she think Dot had said something to the nurses to banish her to the ICU? But what was it Dot shouldn't have said? She was feeling better, though. Clearer, with no new seizures. The next day, friends from school stepped in again, and she was able to have a whole conversation with them without feeling dizzy and nauseated. Then her mother appeared in the doorway wearing jeans and a t-shirt instead of work scrubs. Dot didn't have time to pretend she was sleeping. Her mother's face broke when she saw Dot awake. She made a big deal out of placing her car keys in a pocket of her purse. When she looked up again, there were tears in her eyes. "Aren't you supposed to be at work?" Dot said coldly. Her mother settled on her bed.
"I took the day off."
She inspected her carefully, sort of hesitantly.
"I'm really sorry, Dot."
"Sorry about what?" Dot asked.
Dot's mother's eyes filled. "Everything."
Then she pulled a box out of her purse. Inside was a music box with a spinning ballerina on the top. When she turned the crank, the box played Somewhere Over the Rainbow. "Ballerinas?" Dot said, making a face. Her mother's smile twitched.
"I know it's not your thing. I just thought..."
She made the ballerina spin again. They watched her dance in silence. Not long after, the fog that had hung in Dot's head was completely gone. The doctors announced that her blood work numbers were perfect, and there was no more suspicious brain swelling. They even did a trial day without seizure medication, and even then, the seizures didn't return. Dot's mother, her soon-to-be stepfather, and her stepsister met with the doctors. And though it was a happy meeting, Dot couldn't stop thinking that there was something wrong with the family picture. It was supposed to be Dorothy in here with her, finally seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
"When will Dorothy come back?"
Dot asked her mother. Dot's mother industriously packed her things into a new plaid suitcase. "You're going to love our new house. Almost all the renovations are done."
"Has Dorothy seen it?"
"And your room. It's very big, Dot. And it has a window seat. You've always wanted one."
"Is Dorothy out of town?"
Finally, her mother looked at her squarely. "I have no idea," she admitted offhandedly, as though the question were a little absurd. As though Dot had just asked the whereabouts of a certain squirrel they saw at the park, or whatever happened to that ladybug who frequented their upstairs bathroom.
"Do you know why she left?"
One shoulder rose. "She's like this, Dot. She's always been like this. She comes and goes. You can't rely on her." Something in her face shifted, and her throat bobbed. And then, "Your room's a little oblong and unconventional, but I think you can make it work." Despair and anger rattled through Dot. Clearly, her mother was still jealous of Dot and Dorothy's special bond. What if her mother hadn't told Dorothy their new address? What if she was never able to find them? What was wrong with her mother? Then she realized she had a cell phone. She could text Dorothy the address herself. Take that. Buoyed once more, she asked,
Can I pick the color for my walls?
Her mother paused from packing.
What were you thinking?
Black. Dot grinned nastily. Her mother zipped up the suitcase efficiently and then grinned right back.
Perhaps yellow would be more cheerful. I was thinking yellow and gray.
Nurse Lisa, on the prowl by Dot's door, beamed.
Yellow and gray is a lovely combination.
She went to hug Dot goodbye, but Dot ducked away from her arms. Could Lisa also have had something to do with Dorothy's leaving?
They're jealous bitches,
Dot thought, remembering what Dorothy had said about the nurses. Even though it was just in her head, swearing made her feel embarrassed and ashamed. But it also made her feel kind of better, too. Eliza. My agent Laura calls the next morning while I'm still in bed. I should be up, of course, doing sun salutations or jogging or greeting the day with a barbaric, disease-free yawp. But instead, I'm under a thick mink blanket, drooling.
You sure came up with a creative way to drum up attention for this book,
Laura crows after her assistant patches me through. Huh? I sit up creakily and look at the clock. It's 6:14 a.m.
This stunt at the pool? The press is amazing. It was picked up off that little Palm Springs website, and now it's gone viral. The Dots is on the map. There have been 3 articles about you on publishing blogs. Even more people are clamoring for an advance copy than before, and your pre-order sales got a bump. Good going, girl.
I start to say something, but she talks over me.
There are even rumors that you think someone's trying to kill you.
She lets out a short little ha of breath.
You really are like Dot from the book. It's a performance piece, really. Life imitating art.
Keep it up. I've never met my agent because she lives in New York and I have a fear of flying, but I've concocted a mental picture of her that I envision every time we talk. I see her as a tall, stalk-like tornado of a woman with sleek, perfectly highlighted hair and a large square diamond ring on her right hand. I bet she has wide, frantic eyes that rarely blink. I bet she's one of those people who makes constant eye contact. I bet she screams at her assistants, but they are still devoted to her, like tortured but pampered little lapdogs. I still can't believe she even likes my book. A week after I'd mailed the first draft to Laura, she'd called me in hysterics.
This is great! Chilling.
Wait, really? It seemed so unfathomable. I was proud of the book, but also embarrassed by it. Maybe the story was silly. Maybe it was the most ridiculous thing ever written. I'm not a very good judge of good fiction versus bad, considering all I've read my whole life was epic poetry and trashy horror. I wondered if every so-called writer went through such a roller coaster of ambivalence, or if it was just me. Now I wriggle my feet out from under the covers and gasp. I have forgotten that I painted my toenails black last night in a post-sex with Andrew sloppy drunken flurry, and for a moment, I think I have gangrene. I didn't try to kill myself, I tell Laura. We need to issue some kind of statement.
It's not like anyone believes what they read on the internet, Laura scoffs.
The point is, you're officially interesting. I've gotten a few requests for interviews. Your publisher wants to send out more galleys to bigger reviewers. Do you have anyone you'd like me to send it to?
Just don't send it to my family,
I say haltingly, almost in a shout. I swallow hard, embarrassed by my flurry of emotion.
I didn't mean family, Laura says, unless they work for Entertainment Weekly or People. Do you know anyone from there?
Do you know any booktubers, any bookstagrammers? I don't even know what those words mean, I admit.
Oh, okay. No matter.
Oh, but also, I haven't given out your phone number yet, but don't be surprised if reporters figure it out and start calling you.
How are they going to figure it out?
I cry, feeling a clutch in my chest.
Do I have to talk to them?
Absolutely not. I don't want you giving away anything about the book before it comes out. I think it should be a huge mystery. Who is this Eliza person? Is her book true or false?
The book is false!
I almost scream. I know that. I'm just saying people will wonder now. You officially have Mystique. The marketing and publicity teams are over the moon. And then, once the book drops in stores, you'll go on a tour.
A tour? I repeat ludicrously, as if I've never heard the term.
Signings, readings, Q&As.